The Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI.
Welcome back, everyone, to the deep dive.
Yeah.
Today, we're tackling a really big topic, one where, you know, human values and what science can do really collide. We're talking about medical ethics.
It's a huge field.
It is. And our mission today, well, it's pretty focused. We want to get into the essential frameworks that come from Tony Hope's work. He makes this powerful point that medicine isn't just science. It's fundamentally a moral thing. It throws up these really complex dilemmas all the time.
Constantly.
So we're looking for that toolkit, you know, the sort of common language that helps doctors, patients, families, everyone, really, have a reasoned discussion when the stakes are just incredibly high.
And it's really not just for doctors or philosophers, is it? This stuff matters to you listening right now.
Absolutely.
Because, well, we all need this kind of ethical literacy just to navigate the healthcare system these days, whether you're a patient or maybe making decisions for a loved one, or just as citizens thinking about policy.
Exactly. We need to understand the terms of the debate. And Hope's work, I think, is great because it tries to cut through some of the emotion and ask, how do we actually handle this stuff? How do we navigate these really morally complex situations in a way that's principled, humane, and importantly, something we can justify publicly?
Okay, so let's talk about the person behind this toolkit then, mm-hmm. Tony Hope. His background seems pretty central to why his framework is so effective.
It really is. He's an emeritus professor of medical ethics, sure, but the thing that makes him stand out, the real source of his insight, I think, is that he was also a trained psychiatrist.
Ah, okay. So he's seen it from the inside, not just theory.
Precisely. That's the key. Hmm. His viewpoint kind of bridges that gap between, you know, abstract moral philosophy and the actual messy, often really emotionally intense reality of clinical practice.
He's dealt with the hard cases.
He spent years dealing directly with issues like capacity, coercion, mental illness, high-stakes decisions where someone's ability to choose is right at the center of the problem.
So when he talks about autonomy, it's not just a concept.
No, it's grounded. He's talking about the real, sometimes fragile, ability of a patient to make a rational choice, often when they're in crisis. And that's why his analysis feels so practical. It's full of real-world examples, and he manages to avoid getting bogged down in overly academic language.
Yeah, that grounding makes a huge difference. Okay, so Hope says, before we solve anything, we need a shared vocabulary. And he gives us that with this this four principles toolkit. Pretty standard now, isn't it?
It really is. You could call it the kind of operational language for modern bioethics. These principles, they give structure to the conversation.
Even if they don't just hand you the answer on a plate.
Exactly. They're meant to be weighed up, balanced against each other. So let's quickly define them. For the patient, what do they mean? First, autonomy. That's the patient's right to self-determination, basically to make your own informed decisions about your body and your care without being pressured.
Okay, number one.
Second, beneficence. This is the active duty of the medical team to do good, to act in ways that promote the patient's overall well-being.
Being actively doing good.
Third, non-maleficence. This is the duty to avoid causing harm. It's a really old idea. First, do no harm.
The classic injunction.
And fourth, justice. This one shifts the view a bit from the individual patient to, like, the bigger picture society. It demands fairness in how we distribute scarce medical resources, things like ICU beds or organs, and also the burdens, like who participates in research.
Okay, those are the four. But the crucial insight from Hope, as you said, isn't just knowing the principles, it's realizing that ethics kicks in when they clash.
Exactly, that's the whole point.
It's about the balancing act. That tension is the ethical dilemma.
That's it. Ethical skill isn't about memorizing rules, it's about spotting those tensions and figuring out how to weigh them up. Hope uses four classic conflicts to show how this toolkit works. They're really illuminating.
Let's dive into those then. The first one, maybe the most fundamental clash, is autonomy versus beneficence. You mentioned the shift away from paternalism.
Right, the old doctor knows best model.
Toward putting the patient's rights front and center.
And the ultimate test case here, the really sharp end, is the patient who refuses life-saving treatment.
Okay, give us an example.
Imagine a competent adult. Maybe for religious reasons or just deeply held personal beliefs, they refuse something essential like a blood transfusion. The medical team knows almost certainly they'll die without it.
So the doctor's duty to help beneficence is screaming, intervene.
Absolutely. Save this life. But respecting autonomy means, well, it means honoring that patient's deliberate refusal, even knowing the potential outcome.
And the key thing Hope stresses here is that autonomy isn't just about agreeing with the doctor. It's the right to make choices the doctor might think are, well, frankly, bad choices.
Terrible choices, maybe, yes. And that places a huge weight on the physician. But Hope emphasizes that in modern ethics, if the patient truly has capacity, if they understand the situation, the risks, the consequences, then their autonomy generally carries immense weight. Sometimes it does override beneficence.
Because it's their life, their value.
It's your life plan, exactly. That has to guide the care, ultimately.
Okay, so that's the clash over who decides.
Yeah.
What about the treatment itself? That brings us to conflict number two. Beneficence versus non-maleficence. Doing good versus not doing harm.
Yeah, this happens every single day in hospitals. Think about aggressive chemotherapy, for example.
Right, or major surgery.
It might extend life or offer a cure that's beneficence. But it can also cause immense suffering, terrible side effects that's violating non-maleficence, causing harm. How do you justify that?
It's a tough calculation.
It is. And to navigate this, Hope explains a really crucial, though sometimes controversial concept, the doctrine of double effect.
Double effect. Okay, that sounds a bit philosophical. How does it work in practice? How do doctors actually use that, especially proving intent?
That's the million-dollar question because it does get criticized. But Hope argues the ethical and often legal line is drawn based on the primary intent. The doctrine says an action is permissible if the intended effect is good, even if there's a foreseen, but importantly unintended, bad effect.
Okay, so the classic example is pain relief at the end of life.
Exactly. Palliative care. Using high-dose morphine to relieve truly unbearable pain, that's the intended good effect. Comfort, relief from agony.
Even if everyone knows, it might also hasten death.
Right. That's the foreseen, but crucially unintended bad effect. The doctrine says that's ethically acceptable because the primary goal, the active intent, was pain relief. If the intent was to shorten life, even out of compassion, well, that's different. That crosses into euthanasia or assisted suicide territory, which is a whole other ethical debate.
So it hinges entirely on the primary moral objective, intended versus merely foreseen. That distinction is subtle but powerful.
It's critical for understanding many medical decisions.
Okay, let's move to that other territory then. The really high stakes end of life debate. Conflict number three, autonomy versus societal fear. You mentioned euthanasia.
Yes, and Hope uses the real life case of Diane Priddy to frame this. She was a British woman, remember, with motor neuron disease.
Right, she was mentally competent.
Completely, but physically unable to end her own life without help. Her whole campaign was built on autonomy. She argued she had the right to control the manner and timing of her own death as part of her self-determination.
A fundamental claim. And the resistance came from where? What were the counterarguments?
Well, partly the principle of the sanctity of life, certainly. But a huge factor was the slippery slope argument. This is really about societal fear.
Fear of what, exactly?
The fear that if you legalize voluntary euthanasia, even for competent adults making a clear choice, you won't be able to contain it. The argument is that the system will inevitably slide, putting pressure on vulnerable people, the disabled, the elderly, perhaps those with depression that could be treated.
The fear they might feel like a burden or be subtly coerced.
Precisely. That they might feel they ought to choose death. So Diane Priddy's very personal, autonomous request immediately bumped up against these deep societal anxieties about protecting the vulnerable. It shows how individual choice connects to the whole system's moral foundation.
Okay, so if that's about societal boundaries around individual choice, the fourth conflict, justice, tackles the system itself head on. This is about distributing resources, right? Moving away from the individual bedside.
Exactly. Hope calls these situations tragic choices because sometimes there just isn't enough to go around. The classic thought experiment is the resource allocation dilemma.
Who gets the last ventilator in a pandemic? Or the one available kidney for transplant?
Those kinds of impossible decisions. This is pure distributive justice. And these choices aren't just medical, are they? They're deeply political and economic, too.
So what criteria does Hope suggest we use? How can we possibly make these choices fairly?
Well, he highlights that there isn't one single answer. We often rely on competing principles. You could go for utility, try to maximize the overall benefit, give the resource to the person with the best chance of long-term survival, perhaps.
Or you could aim for equality.
Right. Everyone gets an equal chance, maybe through a lottery system. Or you could prioritize need, give it to the person who is most critically ill right now.
Different principles lead to different outcomes.
They do. And Hope's point isn't necessarily to pick one principle over the others. The real ethical challenge is making sure whatever criteria are chosen, they are transparent and publicly defensible. If people don't understand or trust the reasons behind these allocations, it doesn't just feel unfair, it erodes trust in the whole system.
That makes sense. The process has to be seen as legitimate. Now, Hope also touches on how technology keeps pushing these boundaries, right? Stretching the principles into new areas like genetics and mental health.
He does. On the genetics front, think about prenatal screening, screening for conditions like Down syndrome, for example.
The technology offers information, choices.
It does, but Hope raises a really profound question. Does the very availability of this tech, maybe combined with societal pressures for perfect babies, subtly nudges towards a kind of modern eugenics?
Wow, that's a heavy thought.
It forces us to confront what value we place on different kinds of lives and whether we might be unintentionally undermining the duty of beneficence towards people with disabilities.
And in his own field, mental health, the clash between autonomy and beneficence is particularly sharp, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The whole justification for involuntary treatment, compulsory detention, or medication hinges on this. It arises when someone's illness, tragically, impairs their capacity to make rational self-protective choices.
So you intervene to protect them.
You intervene out of beneficence to protect their welfare, potentially saving their life. But you do so by overriding their autonomy, their liberty. Hope explores where that line is. When is capacity truly lost? Who gets to judge that? And based on what standard? It's the ethical hot zone of psychiatry, really.
Okay, that covers the principles and the main clashes. Let's zoom out a bit now. If someone listening takes away just a few core messages from Hope's framework, what should they be? What are the key themes?
I think there are three really big ones that Hope emphasizes for, you know, building ethical literacy. First, and maybe most importantly, ethics is a balancing act. Always, we have to resist that urge to find one simple, single right answer. The real work, the actual skill, is in weighing those competing values carefully, depending on the specific situation.
No easy formulas.
No easy formulas. Second, he really stresses vulnerability and duty. He argues that you can judge an ethical system by how well it protects its most vulnerable members.
Like who?
The incapacitated patient, children, people with cognitive impairments, maybe research subjects who don't fully grasp the risks. The system is ethically weakest, precisely where the patient is least able to advocate for themselves. That's where our duties are strongest.
That's a powerful point. And the third takeaway?
The third is really the guiding philosophy behind the whole toolkit. It's a paraphrase of his idea. Principles provide a framework for thinking, not rules for acting.
So it's a process, not a rule book.
Exactly. Ethics isn't like looking up an answer in a manual. It's a systematic way of thinking, of reasoning through dilemmas. It's a skill you develop.
That feels incredibly empowering, actually. It shifts things. Understanding informed consent, for instance, isn't just about signing a piece of paper.
Not at all. It should be a conversation.
So how does this toolkit help, you know, you, the patient, the family member, in a real situation? How does it apply practically?
Well, I think it gives you the confidence, maybe the vocabulary, to step up and be a real partner in your own care or the care of a loved one.
To ask better questions.
Exactly. To ask the questions that go beyond just the clinical facts. Questions like, okay, which of these ethical principles seem to be pulling in different directions here? What are the real risks and benefits for me, given my values? What happens if we choose to do nothing? What are the alternatives? It helps you frame the discussion around what matters to the patient.
Right. It shifts the conversation from simply being told what to do towards a genuine discussion about aligning the medical options with the patient's own goals and life plan.
And Hope's fundamental argument is that this kind of ethical reasoning isn't some mysterious add-on. It's not optional. It's a learnable skill, and it's absolutely integral to providing good medical care. Technical brilliance isn't enough without ethical competence.
So our final provocative thought for you, the listener, to maybe mull over, it builds on that future element. Technology isn't slowing down. We've got AI starting to influence diagnosis and treatment plans, incredible advances in genetic editing like CRISPR.
The landscape is constantly changing.
It is, but the core principles, Hope outlines autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, justice, skills. They still apply. They remain our moral compass. But figuring out how they apply in these new, often unforeseen contexts, that's the ongoing challenge.
And it's not just a challenge for doctors or ethicists.
No. We all share some responsibility here, don't we? For shaping the ethical future of medicine. It extends way beyond the hospital walls.
I think this work helps democratize that conversation. It shows why we're all necessary stakeholders in this huge moral enterprise that is modern medicine.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.